No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I am joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. Today we're going to continue our ongoing discussion about anything important we can think of, which is to say, I had a busy week, couldn't find a guest, and couldn't reach Kathleen because she was down in Douglas punching cows or whatever they do down there. So before we go any further, let me introduce my co-host and my favorite cowgirl, Kathleen Juanita Annie Oakley Gomez, who is joining us from the great state of Arizona. Yippee-ki-yay, Kathleen. Thanks for helping to get the conversation started.
Hello, Senator Brown, and how are you? I haven't heard yippee-ki-yay in so long. I said to my son the other day, well, let's mosey on down. And he goes, what? He goes, what is this, some kind of Western? And then I said something else, like a yippee-ki-yay. And he goes, like, what are we, in a John Wayne movie? And I thought, that was stuff we used to say. I mean, what the heck?
You know, man, I so wanted to be a cowboy when I was a boy in Newark, New Jersey. You can imagine in Newark, New Jersey, you know, there hadn't been a cow in Newark, New Jersey in 100 years when I was a kid. But I wanted to be a cowboy, and I wanted to be a Lone Ranger kind of cowboy, you know, because if
you remember, want to be one of those.
The Lone Ranger never killed anybody. He would wound them, or he would outsmart them somehow, but he never actually had to shoot anybody. So, And I have fond memories of coming down to Arizona.
I know.
Yeah, and going to Tombstone.
Yes, Tombstone. That's right. The town too tough to die.
Too tough to die. And let
me
tell
you, motto.
When you go into the cemetery, the old Boot Hill, and you look, my favorite tombstone was a guy that they had his name and it said "Hang by Mistake."
That's true. He was hung in the town square. I think they thought he had stolen a horse or something, and they hung him by mistake. Yeah, that's the way they do it. And they're still kind of like the Wild West. I mean, Arizona is still a lot like that, you know, kind of like, oh yeah, gee, made a mistake. Oh, okay, well, let's move on.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's the first guy we hang by mistake. Yeah. So, but anyway, It's good to have you on the show, and I'm looking forward to coming to Douglas again, but not in the summer, man. I hear that it's just this summer
is dry heat. It's dry heat. You go into the shade and it's like about 15 degrees cooler, and you don't sweat. Like back there, you guys, it's humidity, so you're always wet. Here, you're always dry.
You know what? That's what they say in Arizona, but it's still 110 degrees, even if it's dry.
Yeah, but in D.C., it'll be like 85, and it'll be 90% humidity and feel like 150, and then you're sticky.
That's true. It's a nasty place in the summertime.
It is. It's a swamp. Why did they build Phoenix on the bottom of an ancient lake bed that's like below sea level?
Well, I don't know. But I know why they built Washington in the swamp, because I think George Washington owned the land.
And is that?
You know, sold a lot of it. So, you know, that old saying, I've got some swamp land in Florida I want to sell you. Well, that's pretty much what happened in Washington. I think that old George said, well, what the hell am I going to do this? I know, I'll sell it to the government.
There you go. It works every time.
Works every time. And while we're on the subject of Washington, we have good news on the statehood front in the District of Columbia. We have a new co-sponsor this week, Marcy Kaptur, of a proud Democrat from Ohio, brings our total to 66 co-sponsors of the statehood legislation. And I'm proud to say that my lovely and talented assistant, Rachel, and I spent an entire day with 29 educators through a program from the University of Toledo, and we lectured them all on statehood. And 5 days later, their congresswoman signed onto the bill. So we hope that that was because they lobbied her on our behalf. I don't know if that's true or not. I'd like to think that they had a stake in it. So thanks, guys. If you're out there listening, we're really proud to have the congresswoman from Toledo. She's one of the longest serving. She is the longest serving member in the House today, a woman member in the House today. She served for 31 consecutive years. She is on the Appropriations Committee, an amazing woman. So we're glad to have Representative Kaptur on the bill, and thank you so much for standing up for the people of Washington, D.C.
Good. That is incredible. See, I do think it's so important to reach out to these communities, and you should be like on the road traveling, giving speeches at high schools and stuff, because it does. I mean, that right there shows if you just educate people and get them involved, you know, you just have you need about 50 or 60 more?
Well, you know, I don't think that that it really depends on how many co-sponsors you have to whether a bill will come to the floor and be voted on. But our strategy is that in the House right now, by the way, Kaptur is the 66th Democrat to sign onto the bill, and there are 16 Democrats in the House. No Republicans.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever. So although we're reaching out to them, but we don't see this really coming to a vote in the House at this point. But our strategy is to build up as many co-sponsors as we can. So in the next Congress, keep your fingers crossed, if the Democrats regain control of the House, or even the following Congress. You know, this is just an ongoing problem. It's been there for 213 years, so it's not going to go away. So we're just trying to get as many supporters as we can in both houses of Congress, in the hopes that when the environment changes a little bit and is more receptive, that we'll be able to get this through.
Well, you know, I have to disagree with you. I have to disagree with you on the fact that sponsorships don't matter. They do. Because if there is a lot of sponsors on that bill, it gives it weight to have that bill come to the floor. If you have a piece of legislation that's got like, you know, 20, 30 co-sponsors, you're never going to see that come to the bill. The more that you have on there, and you know, that's just, unless it's changed a lot, but when I was on the Hill, that's what made the difference. When we introduced the Military Family Family Act, it was, didn't get movement until we started getting people to sign on it, and then it did actually reach the floor, floor of the House and the Senate. You know what's amazing too is, I worked on that a long time. It was me and this other fellow. I think she was from Boston University, or I don't know. Was she from Cambridge? Susan Shalhoub. And we wrote this bill. And it was amazing that when it finally got to the point where it got passed, it no longer had our names on it, but became, I think, Kennedy's bill, even though Congresswoman Schroeder had been the only one that introduced it. And so it's amazing. If you ever see this pass, it'll be amazing how it'll end up being somebody's, will get, you know, what do I want to say? We'll get the credit for it. Yeah. Who had nothing to do with the event. It's amazing.
Well, everybody's the mother of success.
That's right.
You know, I understand exactly what you're saying, and maybe I misspoke, but we know that the more co-sponsors we get, the better off we are. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is we're not going to push the, you know, we don't see the bill passing in this Congress, regardless of how many co-sponsors we get, but maybe in the next Congress. And, you know, it's funny that, you know, something else you mentioned, that you and this other person wrote the legislation. Well, that's another thing we're doing. We're meeting with legislative aides, and we're meeting with, you know, people administrative assistants and people in the office. Mostly citizens groups are doing that. And that has a great impact, because these are the people that the members go to for not only to write the legislation, but for advice on what to do with the legislation. So we have activists here in the District of Columbia. There's a guy named Josh Birch, for example, and there's also the shadow representative, Nate Bennett Fleming, and they're working hard in the House and in the Senate to get these people on board, and they've been very successful and very helpful in that regard. Right. So we know how important the staff is. But, you know, that leads us to our first topic of discussion. I think we've decided we want to talk a little bit about getting involved. You know, I know that you've pushed it every week. You tell people to get involved, get involved, get involved. And it's so important that you do that, especially at the local level. And the reason is that this is where the decisions get made. And if you're not part, if you're, we like to say, if you're not sitting at the table, then you don't get fed. And sometimes, actually, if you're not sitting at the table, you're on the menu. So it's it's good to make sure you have a seat at the table, right?
That's right. Because then the other thing that a lot of people always say is, you know, the squeaky wheel gets through, and it's true. If you're there every week or every month talking about, you know, your issues, they eventually, they will have to deal with you. You have to be persistent. You can't accept no. You have to keep on going, reminding them, the politicians or the people that you're seeking to help you with whatever effort you are, that you pay their salary. It's taxes. It's your city taxes, or it's property. It's whatever. It's the taxes that you pay that pay these people's salary. And I think if we could just figure that out and absorb that one kind of thought, they work for us, they should work for us then. And you make them work for you, and if they don't, then you get somebody else in there to run. And maybe that's you.
Well, you know? And that's, you know, that's absolutely right. And that's the perfect analogy is that that you're right, that you need to make them take notice. It's like having a cranky, you know, two-year-old. If you can put them down, if you're busy and you can put them down in front of the TV set and he doesn't bother you, that may just be fine. But when he starts tugging at your pants and crying and whining, and, you know, then you have to deal with them. You got to say, right, yeah, this is a child that needs something and I need to take care of it right now. So that's what we got to do. We got to whine and cajole and push people. And you're right, that's the way a lot of people get into politics in the first place. You know,
it's
that's certainly how I got into politics, and I got into it, I'll tell you, my first elected office was a thing called ANC commissioner in Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., we have the city broken up into neighborhoods, and then the neighborhoods, each little part of the neighborhood has a commissioner who is supposed to advise the city council and agencies within inside the city government on problems in the neighborhood. And they deal with very typical problems, you know, like you're having a problem in the dog park because people don't clear enough after the dogs, or you need a stop sign somewhere, or somebody wants to renew a liquor license. The first place they go is the ANC, and the ANC reviews whether they've had any liquor complaints, any violations, if the neighbors are upset because they come out in the morning and they're drunks on their front lawn and things like that. And then they the first step to getting your liquor license renewed is going through the ANC commissioner, ANC commissions. And the way I became an ANC commissioner was we had a problem in our neighborhood, a transportation problem, and we formed a committee, and we worked on getting bus routes changed and not changing certain bus routes and getting better transportation for the neighborhood. And we felt that the people at the advisory neighborhood commission level, we're not being responsive to our needs. So somebody said one of us has to run for the ANC so that we have some influence on transportation issues. And of course, I stepped forward.
Of course, you can help yourself.
Right. You should always be careful what you wish for in life. And I ran for the ANC commission seat. And it's funny because in my first race, I was geared up. I was ready to go, man. I had my campaign all together and my campaign literature. And, you know, and I was running against the guy who had been in there for years. And as soon as I announced my candidacy, he dropped out. He said, if somebody else wants a job, give it to him. So he left, and my big campaign ended up being me, and I won by default, I guess. But that's how I started to get involved. And once you get involved, you stay involved. You know, that's another thing.
Right.
You should get people involved. You talk about this all the time, Kathleen, how your ex-husband came from a totalitarian state, his family did, and they weren't allowed to get involved. And you know, my grandmother was the same way. My grandmother was an immigrant who came to the United States and from Italy, and she never missed voting. When she was in her 80s, she was out there voting every time because she understood that that was her one chance to get input into the system, and she didn't see it as a privilege as much as she saw it as a responsibility. And I think people should, you know, there's an old saying, the only thing it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. So I think we all have a responsibility to get out there and vote. And it's a contact sport, though. You got to be ready for it. You know, we see Hillary Clinton. You and I were talking about Hillary Clinton. And we've seen this week that in the polls, she has very strong popularity. She's got above a 50% approval rating. So that's pretty good going into elections. But we see that conservatives are starting to line up against her.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. We've talked about this a lot. You know, ever since she kind of started to get involved, I think I remember when she started to deal with the issue of health insurance back in Clinton's administration. Yeah. And I remember when she was kind of her first real public role as doing something other than being really a first lady. How many males actually see at the mention of her name? They have such strong reaction to her that I've always been kind of shocked by it. I've never seen that kind of real resentment or hatred against any woman really in politics. And I think we were talking about it, and you know, the conclusion was that one thing about Hillary is she really doesn't play the female role to men. She doesn't present herself in a cutesy way, in a kind of attractive way. She's just about business, and she doesn't really care if she ruffles the feathers of men. And I think men react to that. Because even I remember when Pat was running for president, I remember, you know, she had a big smile, you know, big teeth, big smile. It was kind of her trademark. And she always wrote this like little, she had a, for her Pat, she had a big like P, a big circle, and then she put a little smiley face. And when she ran, I remember there was this whole team came in and told her, you got to cut your hair, you got to stop smiling, got to stop signing your name like this and this and this and that. And she really didn't go with it, but I mean, she got her hair redone and all that stuff. And I think Hillary doesn't really even minutely play to trying to make the men like her. It's just like, you know, if you like me, you like me. I don't really care. And I think that bothers them.
Well, yeah, of course it does. I think that when you move outside a traditional role, and if you look at very successful women politicians in this country, that very often they're still very feminine, and they exude all those traits of femininity. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that if that's what you want. I certainly have known some really powerful women who are very straightforward and very businesslike, but also, you would call them ladies. People like Lindy Boggs of New Orleans, Louisiana, who was, you know, her husband was a famous member of Congress, and then she took over after his tragic death. Cokie Roberts is her daughter, right. And her son is one of the biggest lobbyists in Washington. She comes from a strong political family. And there's a lady, let me tell you, she was no nonsense. She was all about business. She's a great politician. You know, one of my favorites was a lady named Millicent Fenwick from New Jersey. She was a Republican.
But she had class. I mean, she dressed.
She had class.
She dressed, man.
She smoked a pipe.
She was I remember being in the Congress when she was there, and I used to think, God, this woman has got it. She'd be walking down with big hats, you know, like she was going to like the Kentucky Derby. I mean, she was dressed. She was an elegant lady. That was the one thing about her.
She used to say, you should vote for me because I'm too rich to steal and I'm too old to lie. And I thought that was a good slogan. Too rich to steal, too old to lie. And she was amazing. And we were talking earlier about another Republican woman who I love, which was Elizabeth Dole. I think that, you know, she played both sides of that card very, very well, in that she was always kind of exuded that kind of lady thing. But then she was a graduate of Duke Law School and a top-notch attorney, from what I understand, and president of the Red Cross. She had, you know, in her own right, was a very successful woman. But I think you're right. I think Hillary plays it. You know, I am who I am.
Right.
And men have a hard time with that. And that's too bad, because that's one of the problems in politics, is that you constantly have to pander to people. And then they, you know, when they constantly want you to be one way or another, and then they have the nerve to turn around and say, well, you say one thing, but you do another. Well, you say one thing and do another because you say what they want to hear. And I think Hillary's a straight shooter. And I got to say, probably if I could do one thing to improve politics in America, I would revoke the citizenship of Rush Limbaugh. If there was a way we could deport him, I mean, I don't know what poor country.
How
I would
about Karl Rove?
And Karl Rove, maybe we can make a package deal. You know, I know that the president exchanged five people from Guantanamo Bay for a poor Marine sergeant who had been in custody for 5 years. He was let go this week by the Afghanis. He had been in custody. I think he's like 28 years old, so he'd been in custody since he was 23. Yeah, maybe we could trade some prisoners for Karl Rove and Rush Limbaugh. That would be a great idea, because Rush, you know, is such a hater, and Karl Rove, especially in this case, where he said Hillary Clinton may have
being brain damage. I guess, you know, look, and I always like to pull out that the Democrats, you know, have their own, but I must say, I don't hear Democrats being as nasty as these Republican strategists. What a thing to say. I mean, I bet if you look at their lives and what they've done, there'd be a whole slew of things that you would say, I wonder if Karl Rove is really all there. You know, and Rush Limbaugh, he's been an addict. He's, you know, we know he lies. We know that he's very, very much a hater. Instead of having concrete, good criticism that would move us all along, it's all about creating a big division. So I don't understand why people listen to him. I guess I don't have... And I try to understand, because I know people who do. And
I do too.
And they're good people. And I'm trying to think, you not hear what he's saying and how he's saying it, that you can't? I don't know. You know, I guess there's a disconnect, because I cannot understand. You know, there's O'Reilly, you know, I kind of give O'Reilly credit for starting this whole terrible kind of polarization, because I remember very specifically listening to him. This was quite a few years back when he started doing Pinhead and calling people, you know, and I thought, wow, you know, how can he do this on, you know, main media here? This is just terrible. And then he just kept at it. And then it became, well, the Democrats, you know, or CNN or MSNBC, we've got to do a counter, you know, so we'll have our Democratic O'Reilly. And then it just grew and grew and grew. So now we have so many people causing division instead of bringing us together and finding ways to compromise. And they're not going to do it, and the media is not going to do it. So it's up to us, the people, to make that happen. And we do have so much power, but it's so amazing how we give that power up so readily with, oh, what can I do? Well, man, you can do, one person can do a lot. We've seen it. We've seen movement started by one person. So it's you know, I don't know what that little match is that gets lit, that lights that fire, that gets people off their butt, excuse the word, and actually getting involved. Because I don't know, you know, we'll talk about charter schools, but I was reading up on what's happened in New Orleans, and it was amazing how many parents said, what can I do? How can I fight it? You know, I give up. Right. And they don't understand that they can do so much. You know, it's very disheartening. But maybe somehow we can get a critical mass going. There's always that option. But anybody out there, let me give the number again. It's 888-627-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1.
Well, and you know, I just want to add my personal experience here. You know that Karl Rove went to my church, and my church was very small, only at most 100 to 200 parishioners. And anyway, they had an adult education one time a few years ago. They had Karl Rove come and talk about how his Christianity informed his work. And I said to Patty, oh, Lord, I have to hear this. I have to hear how this guy reconciles being a Christian with being a hater. And for those of you that don't remember that Karl Rove turned out a woman named Valerie Plame, who was a CIA agent, he did that. And you should also know that Valerie Plame was a parishioner. So he not only did this to a person who served her country honorably, he did it to a person that he knew personally, who was a member of his church. I mean, the guy's just, in my opinion.
Well, what did he say? What was his words of wisdom?
Of course, the priest was very, very nervous when he saw me enter the room. He's like, oh, my God, here's this Democrat. We all know he's a Democrat. He's an elected official in D.C.
He can't stop talking.
Can't stop talking. And so I asked him the question of how he reconciled how terrible politics was and all the trashy things that have been said. Valerie Plame was an example, but also John Kerry, how they call this man a coward after he had three Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. And he said to me, well, that's the way politics has always been. And I said to him, well, this is supposed to be about informing how your belief as a Christian informs your work, how it motivates you and how it shapes what you do. And he said, well, right from the very beginning, this is what politics is, and we all sign on to that, and that's how it goes, and, you know, and that's that. And I felt like saying, where is that in the Bible? Where does it say, and Jesus said, screw him before he gets a chance to screw you, or say something nasty about them before they get a chance to say something nasty about you? I mean, it's got nothing to do with Christianity. And this guy, I don't think he's a good Christian. I don't think he's a good person. And if you're out there and you disagree with me, please call
us.
Let us know, because we'd like to talk about it.
Yes, we would like to talk about it, because you know, I don't know. I try to be very, you know, pragmatic and look at both sides. And I find a lot of blame with the Democrats, but I just don't find them as mean as the Republicans. I don't know what it is. They're very, very mean people. They say mean things, and they don't really, if they could somehow get off their high moral platform, leave that morality that they feel that they have to govern, make sure that they govern that morality, if they got rid of that platform and went on the fact that taxes are too high, that there's too many regulations, that there's things on the books that should be taken, you know, taken off, I think they might actually have a real good chance at really bringing people onto their party. But, you know, not the way they're doing it. They just can't give up the morality thing. And remember, I always like to quote the Republican from California that we interviewed, when she said, Republicans need to get politics out of the uterus. I mean, it's not just the woman's uterus. It's a lot of other moral issues that they hold on to, which we've said before. How do you have less government when you want to start dealing, bringing government into the morality issue? So you can't have it both ways. But if they would be smart, they might be. I think they would have a lot of people join them. But they got to get rid of all that stuff.
Yeah, first of all, what you're saying about, you know, higher taxes and too much government and all those things, that's what the traditional Republican Party was. That's what the Republican Party was founded on. You know, and in Washington, they love to say, the local Republicans like to say, that they're the party of Lincoln and Douglas. Well, let me tell you something. It's been a really long time since anybody like Abraham Lincoln or Frederick Douglass was in the Republican Party. You know, they've changed so much. And they used to be the party of civil rights, too. Right. I mean, look at the people. Martin Luther King Jr. was a Republican, as most African Americans in the South were.
Right.
So, you know, they've abandoned a lot of their traditional positions, and they become more right wing. And you're right. If they would come a little more to the center, they would, and get back to their basic issues, they would be more popular. And you know, you and I lived through that with the Democratic Party. We were run by the liberals in the Democratic Party when you and I started. And you know, we put up Mondale. We put up Dukakis. Right. We put up these people that were rejected and rejected and rejected. And then there was a conservative movement that started in D.C. in the Democratic Party. And they created a committee called the Democratic Leadership Council, which included people like Al Gore. It was run by a man named Al Fromm.
And Clinton. Bill Clinton and was there when he was governor of Arkansas.
And Sam Nunn.
Right.
From Georgia and very much a military, you know, a hawk in Congress. And they moved the party a little more to the center, and bingo, bango, Bill Clinton, who I got to tell you, we don't remember this today, but you and I were there when Clinton started out. People were like, the governor of Arkansas.
Who is that?
Who's that? He worked at the DNC, for God's sake. Weren't there because he lost his election in 1980. Remember, he lost his re-election as governor. And then he gave the worst, you know, this is the funniest thing, because he turned out to be such a good speaker, but he gave the worst convention speech I've ever heard in Atlanta. I mean, people were falling asleep. It was long and pedantic and just terrible. And but the Republicans really need to take a page out of the Democrats' books and try to do that.
Yeah, they really do. I guess we should take a break. And okay. I got to choose the music this time. And it's a song by the Congos, one of my favorite bands. They're from South Africa. And it's I Want to Know. And I'll tell you, this song is all about I want to know when people are going to stand up and get involved. So I hope you like it. And here we go.
Well, we hope you're out there listening to us and you can hear us.
Right.
Because we're having technical problems, we're told. So we may or may not be on the air. My personal opinion is that Karl Rove and Rush Limbaugh and all the conservatives, knowing what a major impact we're having on America, are blocking our signal somehow. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to get into Kathleen's playlist, so we keep on hearing from the Congo. No, that's
listen, that
I
was
actually
good
like the Congos.
Yes, and that was a good song, because I'd like to know, America, what's going to take for you to get involved. And so call us, call us at
you can hear us.
Yeah, if you can call us, if you can hear us, but 888-627-6008 or BBS Radio 1, you can Skype us at that. I guess now, you know, we were talking about, we've always talked about education being a big deal, and you mentioned to me, and I did some research, and I was just kind of really surprised by this, but, you know, that New Orleans, I guess, as of June 1st, has gone to basically being a all charter school. There are no public schools left in New Orleans. And I was reading quite a few articles about it. And you know, when I was in New York, I personally started a campaign with quite a few other people to stop the charter schools because there's a lot of myth about them. One thing is that they use public money, you know, that should be going to the public schools. But when you go to public schools, there's a lot of accountability. You know, you elect a school board, you have PTAs, you have ways in which parents can get involved. And with charter schools, that does not happen. They get the money, they create their own boards. You don't elect anyone on their board. You don't have any say. There are no PTAs. You know, charter schools, you used to have the neighborhood school, and I think that's what made America great, that foundation of your neighborhood school. You knew your neighbors. Everyone was there in that community. You know, sometimes, you know, your grandfather went to that school, you know, five generations went, but now that's all gone because now you have to apply, and this was what happened in New York, in a lottery system, and you don't know where you're going to go. You could be across town. The other thing is that I know I did not go through charter schools, but there was one public school that I sent my kids to. I tried to get them in because it was one of the best. That was a public school, but it acted like a charter school. In other words, kids were interviewed and parents to see what we brought to the table. And if they didn't like us or thought that we had enough money, could give a lot of volunteer work, were artists or marketing or something like that, if we weren't fitting into what they felt they needed, they didn't accept us. You can't do that in public schools. In public schools, if you're in that neighborhood, granted, you may have a failing school, but at the same time, you can't be denied a space. Charter schools, that's what happens. You know, I remember that Eva Moskowitz, who was a city councilwoman in New York, started her own charter school. And this is the other thing that drives me crazy. I would probably bet that 90% of the charter schools do not have a person who went and got a degree in education. They're a politician, a wealthy matriarch, somebody in business. They don't have the educational backgrounds. And when they hire teachers, you know, there has to be a certain balance. That's not in charter schools. And I was shocked, and I'm sorry for taking up so much time, but, you know, when Katrina hit New Orleans, they called themselves the New Orleans is the recovery. I think it was called the Recovery Act. And yep. They literally swept away. It was called the Recovery School District. They wiped yep. away the old traditional system and set up charter schools. Now, it's really been awful because I was reading this. And actually, I came up some interesting, you know, statistics. Do you know that 44% of city students in District of Columbia are going to charter schools?
Yes. We're almost at half charter schools, and there are more kids, percentage-wise, going to charter schools in the District of Columbia than any other city except New Orleans. Right. And we didn't have a natural disaster here. But let me tell you what, of all those things you said, and you know this better than I do because you worked in the school system on these things as an activist, but the thing that bothers me most about charter schools is the thing you said about them being run by politicians and by ne'er-do-wells and by people that don't have, who have the best intentions, I'm sure, but don't have the educational background.
Right.
Why would we put people through the rigors of getting a background in education and then turn over the management of our school system to people that don't have this background? My wife's a school librarian. She has a master's degree in library and media specialty as a media specialist, and she's always going for continuing education.
Right.
And she has to have so many credits and stuff. Well, then you turn around and you let moms and dads run the school system. It's crazy, I think.
It's not even moms and dads. They're not moms and dads. They're, like you say.
Right. They don't have to be moms and dads. You're right.
No, and they're politicians. Now, let me give you some others. It's interesting that, you know, one of the problems is that it has severed the ties to a community institution, the neighborhood school, you know, which everyone knew and felt, you know, they belonged to. You don't have that. The other big question is now, who's going to assume the corresponding functions? Who's going to have the authority to hire and fire teachers and administrators? Who's going to maintain the buildings? Who's going to run the buses and provide services to special needs students? None of the charter schools, you know, they have their fiefdom and they rule their fiefdom. There's no accountability. So who's going to make sure all these charter schools are doing the right thing, that they're keeping their schools open, that the lottery system is fair? That lottery system is the worst ever, and it was in New York for a long time for charter schools or private schools. It just is awful. Now, I mean, I was lucky. I lived in good neighborhoods. So I didn't have that issue of having a bad school that I had to take my kid to. But, you know, I think that this is going to be one of the tragic things that we will look back and say that was when it really started going downhill, when we lost the neighborhood schools, when we lost our public schools and turned it over to these private people. Now, the other thing that was really, really interesting was there was an article I found that was published by, let me pull it up, the Florida League of Women Voters. They did a study on charter schools. And what they found out was just unbelievable. First of all, they said that 20% of the state charter schools in Florida were closed because of financial mismanagement or poor academic standards. This was a year-long study of charter schools in 28 Florida counties. Charter schools could fill a niche, but for many, their biggest contribution may be to corporate bottom lines. And then it said, with over 576 charter schools in the state, they conducted this survey to understand the oversight, management, accountability, and transparency of charter and private schools. And what they found is 1/3 of charters are run by for-profit management companies.
Right.
Okay?
Well, you know, we have to get our friend Dr. Miller back on the show to discuss.
And many are screened. They screen their students so they can decide who gets in. They drop those who are not successful, and public schools cannot drop kids. You can't say, hey, you know, you've been getting D's, get out of here. You have to find a way to educate that kid. You don't do that in charter schools. They also said that many charters blur the distinction between religious and non-secular schools. And even some churches receive as much as $1 million in lease payments for their facilities that they lease to the charter schools. So charter schools get our taxpaying money, pays for their facility. I mean, they don't pay for anything at all.
Well, and you know what? That really is an important point too for people, is that what you're doing in creating these charter schools is you're bringing politics into the classroom. You're bringing politics into the you know, the way the schools are set up and the administration of the schools. And right now, who knows? Maybe there will be a closing of the gap between rich and poor people in education, because charter schools can fit the, you know, can adjust better.
They don't.
But in the long run, and even if they do that, I don't know that they do that, but that's part of the argument. But in the long run, you can bet that the have-nots are going to even have less.
Well, the thing is that these schools, and I saw them, actually deny. They would take African-American students who are at the top of the class, those geniuses that you get no matter what school they're in. They took them. But they didn't take the kid who didn't know how to read. They didn't take the child who was getting an F in mathematics. They don't want that type of student, and they leave him behind. And I don't know how charter schools are dealing with special needs. You know, I still on a lot of blogs and NICOR, which is the New York Teachers for Progress or something on progressive issues or something. But it's still a big issue. Now, this is the biggest thing that came out of the survey. They did say that their suggestions were that charters should be limited to those that feel unmet needs in identified local school districts. They should have stronger local management oversight and disclosure policies. Financial mismanagement issues must be addressed, because as too often, the privatization of schools leads to financial abuse. But the thing that was interesting is they wrote up a list, conflict of interest concerns. Senator John Legge, chair of the Senate Education Committee, is co-founder and business administrator of Day Springs Academy in Port Richey. Senator Kelly Stargo from Orange County is on the board of McHill Academies. She is on the Education Committee and sponsored the Parent Trigger Bill. Now, the House Budget Chairman Seth McHill is on the board of McHill Academy Schools in Polk County. The same name as his last name, so I wonder if that's his. Annie Corcoran, wife of future House Speaker Richard Corcoran, has a charter school in Pasco County. Richard Corcoran is chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Senator Anitra Flores of Miami is president of an Academica-managed charter school in Doral. Florida Representative Eric Frezen is chair of the House Education Subcommittee on Appropriations, and a representative. And his sister is the vice president of Academica and is married to the president. And it goes on. George Levisky, Florida House lawyer, cleared Eric Ferson of conflict of interest. I mean, it goes on and on. So here we're seeing, look at how many of our legislators are actually running charter schools. And that's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm sitting here and as I think of these things, like what has to happen in the United States? Can at least we get involved in education and do something with this Common Core is just going to be the end of us? These charter schools are not the answer. What is it going to take? And, you know, when I was reading this stuff, I mean, I kept on coming across quotes that saying, you know, what are you going to do? How can we fight the system? I just wish, you know, when I used to go into Crown Heights and give speeches on how to get involved in your school, and we used to actually, this other friend of mine, April Humphrey from the Alliance for Quality Education, we used to give workshops on how to be able to speak to your local school board, you know, the tools so that you're not afraid, because everyone's so afraid of looking stupid. We trained them on how just to go up there and just, you know, talk to these people. And it was amazing how with just a few tools, these parents got it together. And I guess I just don't know what it is that's going to make parents, make the public, make the average Joe Doe just say, you know what, I'm going to get involved. Enough is enough. I have to, you know, and you do. Right. Everyone's got children. If you don't have children, you've got a niece or nephew or your neighbors or whatever. And it's beneficial to us all if they do well. So this is really, you know, remember when I came back and saw you, what was it, 10 years ago when you were talking about the charter schools in D.C. and I had just spent all this time working about them, and how it makes me crazy, you know, that we're just, I don't know what it is, because when you think about our public schools were good when we were going to school, and spewed out all these great men. Even Bill Gates, I'm sure, didn't go to a charter school.
Right. Well, and I grew up as a young boy in Newark, New Jersey, and Newark, New Jersey was one of the worst cities in America, but the public schools were great. New York City public schools were great. You know, my wife went to New Jersey public schools. They were great. But we're running out of time here, and I want to talk about one last thing, because we keep on this is a recurring theme on our show, and we keep on glossing over it because we don't have enough time. I also want to get a word in edgewise, and as long as we talk about schools, that's going to be hard, because I know Kathleen's passionate about it. But one thing is I want to talk about the most recent move by the National Rifle Association. You know, the NRA is trying to block the nomination of the new Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Right. And they're trying to block it because Murthy said at one time that guns were a national health issue. Well, mm-hmm. when we have as many people dying in America as we do from gun violence, surely it is a health problem. It is, you know, something that we should be, we should all be concerned about. And this is really overstepping. I mean, we're supposed to be, these are guys that profess, they're the biggest liars out there, the National Rifle Association, and they profess to protect those things that make America great, like free speech. But then when the Surgeon General steps up and gives his opinion and they don't like it, they do everything they can to stop his nomination. And it's crazy. They've done this before. They stopped the nomination of another health professional. I can't remember the person's name. For 6 years, they stopped it. So we need to stand up to the NRA. They're just—they're nothing more than a trade association that does whatever it can to sell more guns and more bullets. And we've got to stand up and say what this man in California said when he lost his dear son to a guy with an automatic, a semi-automatic weapon, and he said, "Not one more." And it's time, America, to stand up and say, not one more. You know, somebody wrote to the Washington Post today and they said, well, if this guy had lost his son to somebody driving a car, okay, because the guy hit several people with his BMW. Right. If he was killed by the car, would he be blaming the auto manufacturers? Well, you know what? Yes, we would blame the auto manufacturers, and we do may blame the auto manufacturers. And that's why you need, if you own a car, to have it registered, you need to insure it, and you need to prove proficiency in order to operate it. And you need to operate it in a particular manner, or you can be arrested and thrown in jail. So I would be fine with you having any kind of gun you wanted, if A, it was registered, B, it was insured, and C, you proved proficiency with it.
Well,
so,
and you know,
I think
that that's true. And, you know, I looked at a lot of the Facebook comments, and, you know, that's what someone else says, you know, guns don't kill people, people do. Well, quite frankly, in our society today, we have more crazies than probably we've ever had. We have dysfunctional families. We no longer raise kids in a village atmosphere where we all look out for each other. It's all about what you get, and these kids want instant, you know, entitlement. You know, yeah. I want the girlfriend. I want the car. I mean, this kid, it's strange because he had so much. And even
his parents, you know.
So the issue is there's got to be a big movement for mental health, too.
Right.
Because
that's right.
And obviously, I think when you see a YouTube thing like that, like everyone was talking when he was putting up those things, I hate to say it, but maybe there needs to be somebody to review these things and just say, well, let's look at this guy because he definitely, it doesn't look too good. And
well,
especially
you know,
they're talking about getting guns. You know, I don't know who does that, but there's something that's got to be in place because there's just too many people who are losing it and have no real sense of reality. And are angry just because they don't get to be prom queen or they're not popular or that girls don't like them. I mean, how do you go out and shoot people because of that?
Let me tell you something. If I had that attitude, there would have been a lot of women shot in the world. But part of the problem is they did look into this guy. And I've heard the police criticize for not turning him over to psychiatrists, but cops aren't psychiatrists. They came to the man's home and, you know, and he faked it for a few minutes and they said, you know, and he seemed normal enough. And we have guidelines to protect you from being thrown in jail for this and that, you know, for no reason whatsoever. They have to have probable cause. And I don't think we can put this off on the police. I think we all need to get together as a society. And, you know, that's another thing. These are the people that we've hired to protect us. These are the people that we've elected to protect us. And there's not a police chief in America that's against having background checks and having some other things. You know, I don't want to take a gun away from any law-abiding citizen who's mentally healthy and is responsible
to protect themselves.
Right. You know, you have a Second Amendment right to that. Great. But we need to approach this problem. And part of the National Rifle Association interference also interferes with us doing things like psychiatric evaluations, because they stand against everything, background checks, everything. And we need to stop this, America. It's just crazy that seven people lost their lives and 13 people were injured. And this happens time and time again. We're out of time. We got 1 minute left. Kathleen, what do you want to say?
I don't know. Actually, just thank you for listening. If you were able to listen to us, and please, you know, Skype us with your questions. You don't have to come on air. You don't have to be worried about coming on air, but we would really like to hear from you all and help us do something, make a change, make a difference.
And at the very least, email some cool music to Kathleen so she'll be able to play it on the air. And absolutely, we need to do something. We all need to stand together. That's why we started this show, was to get input from people and find out how we can solve some of our tough problems. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.